Welcome, travelers. I'm Josh.
I'm Glenn.
And I'm Lee Wanika, and this is Tabletop Journeys, where we will be your not-so-humble guides on the quest for RPG adventures.
Here at Tabletop Journeys, we are all devoted role players and storytellers at heart, and we absolutely love sharing our passion with you. On our show, we feature diverse tabletop RPG systems, demonstrating them through actual plays and breaking down the rules to provide you with tips, tools, and techniques to help you navigate them. We also love bringing the content creators behind these games into the studio to give you a peek behind the curtain with relevant and insightful interviews.
Let us help you get the most out of your story, no matter what game world or system you're playing, because detailed settings, heroic characters, diverse NPCs, and a focus on story over rules can make any campaign legendary. Now, here's a message from friends of the show.
Hi, I'm Conan Librarian, and I don't have a podcast. I do, however, like most of us, have the need for a place to store, organize, customize, and create my tabletop campaigns, thoughts, and ideas. That's why you should check out obsidianportal.com. Customization that will match any need you have, a fantastic community, and an experience in and of itself that will get your players engaged, not just during the session. ObsidianPortal.com. Your players don't just stay at the tavern. Why should your game just stay at the table? ObsidianPortal.com.
Welcome, everybody, to today's episode. Very excited to be cracking once again into some Wizards of the Coast content, something that we have not done in a very long time. I am very happy to be joined across the microphone, per usual, by my friend and trusted colleague, Mr. Lee Wanika Miller. Lee Wanika, how the hell are you doing today?
I'm doing really well. Look, we've had some really interesting things that brought us to this particular episode tonight, and I'm so excited to get going on it. But yeah, not the least of which is just a real good deep dive and getting back into some of these D&D high fantasy roots in adventure construction. But I've talked a little bit about adventures, adventure construction, how to make an engaging table and an engaging situation. Josh, you've been doing very much the same thing with your vlog as well, with the idea of how do we make this more fun for the people we interact with, whether it be live, virtual, or what have you. And in comes 50th anniversary D&D with the latest and currently greatest, at least that's what they want us to feel about it.
Adventure Path. They've certainly been telling us that it's the greatest adventure. Yeah.
Adventure Path. Hey, Kendrick is a great person to talk about your stuff. I think he genuinely likes the things he likes, and I know that because I listen very intently to the questions he asks, as well as the questions he doesn't ask. So I don't think he shines on about things that he doesn't like. I think he only talks about the good things. And that's an interesting and unique way of doing this type of thing, but he works for them. So that's what you do. You talk about the good, right? So I get that. And I'm really anxious to dig in and do a couple things tonight with this. And that's just talk about the adventure, talk about what it's about, talk about how it works. And then maybe if we can squirrel away a little time at the end, throw out a couple ideas for how we would improve it in a tabletop journeys kind of way. Because I think there's some spoiler
there's some
alert.
Areas of opportunity. Yeah.
There's good there's some decent bones with some interesting ways to make it really shine. Areas of opportunity. Yep.
And it must feel good to go back to an adventure so deeply rooted, because your D&D roots are in Greyhawk, right?
Greyhawk is where I started. It may have been the Redbox adventure, but the people I gamed with, they set it in Greyhawk. I've talked about it on the show many times. I have and still have the big Greyhawk map, and I have little dots and pinpoints when it used to be on a cork board for where different adventure modules from first edition actually we would place them on the map, where we wanted those things set. So at any point, I could carry on my story. People could go, oh, we did this adventure, we didn't do this one. I could pick up an adventure and do it. And I loved that style of gaming. You know, it was basically a world-spanning hex crawl where you could go anywhere. You want to start a new game with a new table, start them over here. There's 15 modules around there, one through whatever. Get going. You want to start over here and there's no module, don't worry about it. Homebrew that crap. At least what's going on in the world. I love that kind of gaming. They really did pitch this as the way to appeal to me, old school AD&D, OAuth gamer. Yeah. That's what they were pitching. Yeah. Let's bring you back home. And
yeah.
There are some struggles.
There's some struggles. So if you have not already figured it out yet, we're going to be talking tonight about Vecna, Eve of Ruin, the latest adventure path, the last adventure path, or the last book, even, in the 2014 rule cycle. Everything after this is going to be based on 1D&D, the D&D 2024, whatever you want to call it, the next iteration of D&D, the next step down the path. This is the last bit of the 2024 iteration. And there is a lot. So it's, the book itself is 250 something pages. I think it's 256 or 260 or something like that. So there's a lot in that book to cover, and we're going to do our best to go ahead and squeeze our thoughts into one episode. And so I think let's start tonight with kind of overall thoughts. And Luminika, I think that you alluded to it already in your opening preamble there, where you said that this adventure has great bones and that there are areas in which it could be improved. And I really think that is the biggest compliment that I can pay it right off the rip here, is that the bones of this adventure are fantastic. It sounds, if you just read the chapter headings on the things that you get to do in this adventure, it's a fantastic path. It really lays out a really interesting story.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Carry on.
Yeah, because that is unfortunately, I think for me, where the biggest compliments are going to stop. I think that there are some things in here that are still good, but I really think that running this adventure correctly in the way that, like, I feel it, and Luminika, I think that you feel it, and that other experienced DMs reading this feel it. It's going to take a lot of heavy lifting on the part of the DM to go ahead and make this really shine. And there are a lot of variations on where that heavy lifting can or should be. But DMs out there, I don't know that you can run this adventure path exactly as it's listed in the book and have it feel satisfying. And we're going to go ahead and get into those reasons throughout there. But DMs out there also, I will say, have faith. Know your material and feel free to color outside the lines that WotC has given you, and you'll be just fine. But it is going to take some coloring outside of the lines.
Yeah, my quick treatise following you on this is great bones. How could you miss?
Right.
You've got OAuth. You've got Neverwinter.
Yep.
You've got the Underdark. You've got Loth. You've got Drow. You've got Kryn. You've got Strahd. You have some of the oldest and most classic and named NPCs in the game history involved in this. And you've got Spelljammer. You've got Planescape. You've got Sigil.
You've got Avernus.
You've got Eberron. I'm going to do my best to not waylay us when we get to that chapter.
You've got Pandemonium.
You've got Pandemonium. Cool. You shouldn't be able to miss with this because of the bones, right?
Yeah.
And yet, in some ways, I think they did, because I think they just missed a little GM assistance here. I think this, as opposed to being sold as a straight up, this is the adventure, run it X through A through Z, should have been more like, here's the adventure framework. We're going to give you key scenes here and here, and we're going to give you some instruction and ideas on how to flavor it for your table. And I think that's where they fell down. Now, I don't know exactly how you do that with the page count and the financial ramifications they have. That's really hard. But I also think at the same time, you don't bite off a multiversal story unless you're down for the fight. I look at the MCU, at least through Phase 3, when they got done with Endgame, they were down for that fight.
Yep.
They knew what they were going to do. They planned it out, and they hit every friggin' mark. They had only one miss, was the proper integration of the television shows into the MCU story, and that was a political, financial business thing that was out of the control of the creative minds. I think they actually had a good plan in mind, but they weren't allowed to bring it to fruition, and that's why the TV shows fell off towards the end there. But the MCU did it because they had the right people saying, we're going to steer this ship, and this is exactly how it's going to go. So you can do a multiversal story. You can connect all these things, but you got to have that straight-up plan right from the get-go.
I think that you nailed the comparison when you said the MCU, because I think for me, the way that you do this adventure path with the way that it needs to be done is it's not one book. I think it's two books, just like they did with Infinity War, right? They realized that Infinity War was a story that was bigger than one movie. Before we go any further, I want to go ahead and make sure that everybody understands that everything that's going to be said from here out in the episode is going to be a spoiler in this adventure. So just go run the adventure, spend the next 3 years, run the adventure, and then come back and listen to us from 11 minutes and 12 seconds into the episode or whatever to go ahead and pick that up.
But let me amend that a second. Yeah. If you're a GM, keep stick going. With us.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Tell your players to wait till you're done running it.
Exactly.
All you GMs out there, here you go. Yeah. If you don't play D&D and you just want to talk about construction and know what all the hubbub is about, bub.
Yep.
Stick right in here.
Yep.
But for the rest of you players out there,
So
spoiler alert.
Yeah, spoiler alert. So imagine how good this book is if it stops after the Night of Blue Fire. And then it picks up part two with what should replace Tomb of Wayward Souls. If it starts with that mission in book two, right?
Yep.
I think that it is a much stronger story, because then in that second book, you've got Tomb of Wayward Souls, you've got the Dragon Queen's Pride, and then you've got the reveal, right?
Yeah.
So you have two more adventures, right? And then you've got the reveal. And here's the thing too. They gave us three Spelljammer books in that pack. They could have given us two books. If they really wanted to go ahead and do this, they could have.
Yep.
And I think that probably for financial reasons, we know what Hasbro's been doing with financials. We know what they've been doing with budget. We know what they've been doing with the layoffs. We know all of those things. And so I am sure that if Jeremy Crawford had gone to his Hasbro overlords and said, "Dear overlords, I want to write two 250-page books and release it in June of 2024, Jeremy Crawford might be working for Paizo right now. He may no longer be working for Wizards of the Coast, because they would have go ahead and cut him like so much chaff away from the wheat, right?
Yep.
And so I get that. I understand the political realities of it. But we're an opinion podcast. That's what we're going to go ahead and do, is we're going to talk about our opinions on this, and I think it's a mistake.
At the end of the day, and with a clear begging of forgiveness that I'm asking of Sean Merwin and Teo Sabadia of Mastering Dungeons, we are here to talk about what's on the page and how it plays at the table.
Yep.
We get all the other stuff, but now we're talking about the experience of what we're reading and what we're going to be rolling dice with. So the rest of it, understand, I'm not casting shade for the sake of casting shade. This is not Hasbro's the devil. YouTube-y clickbait bullcrap. That's not what I'm doing. We're going to talk about this in a, hopefully, y'all be the judge, meaningful way about what's enjoyable, where we have challenges, what we think could be used to improve it, and most importantly, what we think we would do if we're running this for a table, and what other GMs might be able to do, some tips and techniques that they might be able to do to run this at the table. So all the little picky things that we have issues with, your players never even realize were there. Because you can run this in a way that your players don't even know what's wrong with it. That's what we're here to do. This campaign legendary.
So what we're actually going to do, though, is we're going to step aside for just a few minutes here, and we're going to record our Patreon exclusive bit on this adventure path first. And the reason for that is because our Patreon exclusive bit is going to be a dive into the Nest of the Eldritch Eye pre-adventure. So if you are interested in that, go ahead and check us out on Patreon, and we'll give you those details in just a moment. But we're going to step aside, record that, and then we'll be right back. All right, everybody, we are back. Once again, that we just recorded our Patreon exclusive portion of tonight's episode where we talk about Nest of the Eldritch Eye, the precursor adventure. If you'd like to go ahead and check that out, you can go to www.patreon.com/ttjourneys. That will give you all the information that you need to become a Patreon supporter and to get all of our Patreon exclusive content, as well as all of the other really neat benefits about being a Patreon subscriber of our show, not the least of which is that you get invites to our monthly Patreon-only games. We run a variety of games every month for our Patreons, and we have an awful lot of fun doing it. So hope to see you over there. Again, that's www.patreon.com/ttjourneys. All right, let's dive into the main thrust of the adventure here. So we've had our precursor mission. Vecna has revealed that we are somehow cosmically chosen, interwoven with his plans, and then many years go by where other things happen to these characters. Perhaps they have retired, perhaps they have moved on to other phases in life, and then the Wizards Three, the combined faces of Illustrial Silverhand, Tasha the Witch, and none other than Mordenkainen, summon accidentally your party to them in Sigil. I don't know. What's your thought?
If it was Elminster and it was an accident, I'd buy it. If it was Bigby, I'd buy it.
Yeah, yeah.
If it was any mage of either white, black, or gray robes who had tassel or red robes who had Tasselhoff Burfoot underfoot, I would buy that.
Yeah.
I don't know if I buy these two and that. I almost wish, here's our first big spoiler, the person masquerading as Mordenkainen, if it was revealed that they picked these characters on purpose, because at some point he was aware these were the characters that were involved in the first precursor adventure 10 levels ago. That would have made more sense to me than these six random people just got brought here.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And we will talk about this more, I think, when we get into the what would we change about this. The very first thing that I would change about this is I probably wouldn't make Cass be hidden. I probably would put him there with Tasha and Illustrial and basically have Cass plead his case and say, here's the deal, adventurers. The Dark Powers have told me that you are connected to Vecna and have released me from their bond to go take him out. I need you to do this thing. I am bound here to Sigil. I can't leave, but I need you to go on this fetch quest and get the 7 pieces of the rod so that we can go ahead and take care of Vecna. And then he can still double-cross the party once they're done. But at least it gets that weird pretense that he's masquerading as Mordenkainen, and he has a magical artifact that is so powerful that Tasha, with true sight, can't tell he's not Mordenkainen. That's some bullshit right there.
They actually did something that made me feel a little bit better about that. They picked an older version of Tasha. They didn't pick Tasha from Tasha's Cauldron of Everything version.
Right.
They picked her original version from O'Earth. And what I found interesting about this, for a campaign that basically has Illustrial, original Tasha, Cass, Vecna, Later on, a version of Acerak. 5 big named NPCs. And you throw in Morden Caden in there from O'Worth. And not much of this was centered. There's a chapter on it, but not much is centered in O'Worth. That was weird to me. That it's like something didn't come across the goalpost for me there. You've got 5 people from this spot, and yet you barely touch that world. Like, Vecna hates a lot of things, but he's got to hate home more than anything else.
I suppose, maybe.
It just strikes me as weird. It's just weird. Like, it was less of a bad thing more than it was just weird. Like, it was a decent GM is running this, right? Am I having fun with this or something breaking my suspension of disbelief?
Right.
That right there, as soon as you start naming all these people from O'Worth, starts breaking my suspension of disbelief. One of my biggest problems with 5e and actually WotC and D&D, even through 3, 5, and 4e, well, not so much 4e, but every time they take a Greyhawk named character or thing and bring it in and all of a sudden, oh, let's place this somewhere in the Forgotten Realms. I'm like, I bristle at that.
Yeah.
I'm not saying that the Forgotten Realms is bad. I'm just saying Forgotten Realms was good without that stuff before, because I played a lot of Forgotten Realms without having to worry about it. But it was weird to me to find Tomb of Annihilation in Forgotten Realms. That didn't feel good to me. The different things they bring over didn't feel good to me.
Yeah, let's call a spade, right? So the version of Tasha that they bring over is a CR-19 creature. If I have 6 11th level characters, doesn't matter what class, doesn't matter what ability, 6 11th level characters, which is the level this campaign path begins on.
Yep.
That's only a medium encounter.
Yeah, the characters are better than the quest givers.
When we talk about the secret sauce that this campaign path is missing, it's stuff like that, right?
It is odd, but it does make sense, though, if you think about it this way. If the narrative is, we can't solve this multiversal problem, we don't have what it takes, let's call on some folks who can, and they pick your 6 players, because those 6 players are more powerful than the 2 of them.
Yeah, I suppose.
That actually narratively works, but it speaks to why people don't play at higher levels, because you're bigger than the biggest.
Right. And I am also going to disagree with you that I think the layout, or the kind of the pretense that brings the characters to Sigil, I dug it. I liked the whole, this party was connected to Vecna through the precursor mission. But again, imagine this, instead of Cass pretending to be Morden Kanan, right? Imagine Cass goes to Tasha and to Illustrial and says, I've got this situation. You know who I am. You know where I'm from. You know who I work for. And they have sent me here with this information saying, we need to do this. I can imagine Tasha at that point saying, hold on, Cass, we're going to check your story. And Tasha casting Wish to go ahead and see, okay, what the hell is Cass talking about? And what it does is it delivers these 6 players to her feet. Yeah, I can imagine that. I can imagine that happening, you know?
Yep.
That absolutely makes sense to me. I think that the pretense is okay. I just think that the twist that Morden Kanan really isn't Morden Kanan doesn't hold much water, especially because we talked about the secret system, and maybe we dive into that a little bit more here, but one of the secrets that you can learn is that one of Morden Kanan's closest friends saw Morden Kanan in the Sanctum and Sigil and said, I don't think that's actually Morden Kanan, and then doesn't say anything. Like,
yeah,
that's, I'm sorry, but if one of the most powerful wizards in Sigil has just called one of the most powerful parties ever to appear in the multiverse to go ahead and stop one of the most feared demigods in the multiverse, I think that I'd say that maybe one of them's an imposter. Call me crazy, but I think that I would have brought that up.
Yeah.
So let's talk about the secret system a little bit here. So the secret, because Vecna is the god of secrets, the party is, or the campaign, rather, is fueled by the party's ability to find secrets in all of these multiverse locations that they go to. They can use these secrets basically as a meta currency to fuel powers, and they make a big deal in the very last chapter when you are in Vecna's memory palace about the number of secrets that you have held onto. a cool system that I don't think has great secrets attached to it. I think I would go through it. I would modify some of the secrets. Some of them are okay, but there are some other things in there that I think would hold a little bit more narrative import that would be secrets that Vecna would want, and that you can basically set up a race against a rival party. I mean, look at the adventure in Eberron, in the Mornlands there, right? Imagine if there is a secret about the Mornlands that everybody wants to know, and you and a rival party are both chasing, trying to go ahead and find it first. And if the rival party gets it, then Vecna gets it. And if you get there first, then you get it. That is how you get tension and excitement about the adventure. Not by basically introducing this meta currency that the players don't really understand and don't really have an awful lot of information about.
Yeah, I thought the narrative around the secrets could use some help, or at the very least, some better GM instruction. They allude to it being important, and it stays with your characters at the end of the precursor adventure.
Yep.
And so you start this, if you were the characters who were in the precursor adventure, with secrets. But then you're here, and as you go through each chapter and you have the opportunity to learn generally two secrets per chapter of merit, I think that part of me loves this concept, but I don't know if it was, again, brought across the goal line there because of the very same things you're mentioning. I thought the weight of the secrets, some were pretty important to what was going on in those scenes. Others were kind of like, I forgot to feed my cat last week, kind of right. thing. And I'm like, or some mega multiversal equivalent thereof, I didn't take out the trash, or I'm the one who broke the vase and made Bobby Brady glue it. Like, there was some of these were like, they didn't seem to have any importance. And again, there's a fine line here where you want a secret from the chapter you're in that is big, like the secret of that universe.
Yes.
The challenge is, this is a game and not a novel. So the secrets of these universes, and more importantly, it's a tabletop role-playing game. So the secrets of the universes are rarely actually delivered in writing because they want each individual table to create that secret themselves.
Yeah.
The biggest secret in O'Worth, in my campaign, is likely very different than the biggest secret for O'Worth in somebody else's Greyhawk campaign.
Yep.
And so on and so forth. So what I think they should have done with these secrets is had these same ones, but then say, if you've ever gamed, done a campaign or a series of adventures in this world, what was the biggest secret or reveal in that campaign world? And blah, there you go. Or if you've never, so it comes from your table's campaigns. Let's say I only did Forgotten Realms, right? And I never did any of the other worlds. The only thing my people would ever know is the biggest secret for Faerun. So when we're in that Neverwinter chapter, that's the secret that comes out there. Put that secret in the adventure. That's the secret. You get the biggest secret for the world you're in.
Yeah.
And give the GMs the advice. Pick it from the campaigns you've been running at your tables with your group. If you haven't run in a given world, here are D6 options for secrets. Pick the one you think will resonate the best with your table. Done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, all of that has much more merit, and every game world you've gamed in now does something bigger. I know for a fact, even though I've never run a large number of games in Kryn, I would definitely choose the one big adventure path that we wrote here at Tabletop Journeys, Trials of the Tower Initiate. The secret of Val would be the big secret I would choose to reveal during the Kryn message. To me, for people who know me, who've played adventures at my table, that secret has weight. Because even if they weren't playing in that game, they know the adventure we wrote. They listened to Sergio and his Patreons when they ran the adventure on the Lorecast. They hear us talk about it and all of these things. So I think that would be the secret I would run. Thayer and their secrets from the games I've run, the betrayal of one of my big characters, O'Worth, the fact that one of the party members, one of the biggest bad guys, was a tiefling, and mm-hmm. that his twin sister was an ASMR. Yep. These are the secrets from the campaign worlds I've been in that I would put in there.
Yep.
Pro tip, as a GM, when I go to run this at some point in the future, that's exactly what I'm going to do. We'll just add these other secrets in there and give, yep. and that way the secrets have weight and they seem much more important.
Yep. Welcome to the middle of the show. We wanted to take a minute and thank the people who helped make this show possible, our Patreon supporters. We like to shout out our adventurer-level Patreons, so extra big thanks to Tim Morris, Chad Bean, Joe Harney, Dave Rideout, Adam Scaramella, and Marty Napier. Patreon supporters get exclusive content, free copies of all of our published and unpublished game supplements, early access to episodes, and free invitations to our monthly games. You can learn more at www.patreon.com/ttjourneys.
Speaking of published material, have you checked out the supplements we have on DM's Guild? We have two full books, The Traveler's Guide to Collaborative Worldbuilding, The Traveler's Guide to the Multiverse, and you can combine it with all of our supplements to make your next role legendary. Go to www.ttjourneys.com/DM's Guild for more information.
If you're looking for Tabletop Journeys swag or need a fantastic set of new dice, then you should check out the Tabletop Journeys Spring Store and our affiliate, FanRoll Dice. You can make your first purchase through FanRoll at 10% off, and every purchase helps support the show. You can learn more about that at www.ttjourneys.com/FanRoll. And if you want to get some awesome t-shirts, hoodies, hats, or other gear, check out www.ttjourneys.com/swag to get redirected to our spring store. These are the same vendors that we use for our add-ons when we do Kickstarters and stand by their products.
But the best way you can support the show is by joining the conversation. Did you love one of the episodes? Did you disagree with something we said? Maybe you just want us to cover your favorite game system a little more or talk about a brand new system. Check us out at linktr.ee/ttjourneys. That's our link tree. And join the conversation.
We hope you're enjoying this week's show. So here comes the second half. Don't forget to subscribe to the show wherever you're listening to us. And if your platform lets you leave a comment or a rating, why not hit the button and show your support? Thanks again for listening. Now on with the show. So let's crack that nut too, because I think that you are stumbling on the big kind of flaw with this adventure path, and that's that none of the chapters by themselves feel super compelling in furthering the story, right? When we set out our D&D game with our Patreons, or the campaign named Arch Enemies, we haven't finished it yet, so I don't want us to go ahead and spoil how it ends, but you know how it ends, even though you were playing in it, because you and I talked a lot about it, about yes. how this campaign works. And the kind of conceit was that the part of the mission that they're in right now is where they know that they have to take out these five hag sisters. They also know that they didn't get but they did get the second one, and then they got the third one. So far, they know that there's a rival party that's working to go ahead and take out these hag sisters also, and that the score is 2-2, right?
Yep.
Their ability to succeed or fail in taking out these hag sisters has import in what is going to be the big twist and the final big bad, right? Their ability to go ahead and complete these missions matters. It doesn't in this story. They have to complete each mission. If they don't get a piece of the rod, there isn't an alternative. And there isn't any way to get out of not getting the piece of the rod. There's just not.
I think this is the interesting thing. This is where this adventure path, it tries to be the Infinity Saga, but drops the ball to some extent.
Yeah.
Because in the Infinity Saga, they got all of the pieces.
Yep.
The good guys got all the pieces. They put it in a place, but then the bad guy just stole it from that place, which was interesting, right?
Yeah.
But at least the good guys got each piece. Each piece was found. Each piece was revealed. Each piece was put somewhere, with the exception of the piece that went into Vision's head, which they got in the final thing,
right?
If you extrapolate that to a tabletop role-playing game, the problem here is they do the one thing they tell you never to do. Never lock an answer that you need to complete the adventure behind a single fail state. They didn't lock these missions behind a single fail state, but each mission was, in and of itself, a single fail state. You don't get Rod Piece 2, you can't get Rod Piece 3.
Right.
And while I get the fact that's the way this particular magical MacGuffin has been written since time immemorial, that's pretty bad. As opposed to writing it, it gives you the next piece. It should say it gives you the closest piece. So if you don't get it, Cass's minions go behind you and get their pieces. So at the end, either your party won every mission and they have the whole Rod of Seven, big reveal, or you only have three pieces or two pieces or how many pieces you have, and Cass basically fights you for your pieces, and then you realize, oh my god, Cass had the other pieces all along. He was doubling his bets.
There is a rival party also trying to get the Rods of Seven. You get to the very end, you're like, Mordenkainen, we're sorry, we only have five. And he's, haha, that's okay, because I have two. What do you mean you have two? Oh, you're Cass! Or whatever. Like, you know, any number of ways that a rival party also doing the same thing and working against the party that you're in works in your favor. Imagine the adventure in Spelljammer when you are going through that Spelljammer ship on the dead god, right? Imagine getting all the way to the end, getting to the big shiny chest, opening it up, and finding a note from the rival party saying, sorry, suckers, we got here first, right? As frustrating as that would be for players, imagine if they didn't even know that there was a rival party until that. And all of a sudden they're like, wait, what rival party? Holy crap, who's here? Right?
Or they go to the deck of that part of the ship to see the other party getting on whatever they're getting on to leave with their rod, and they're on theirs. There's two different groups in Death House. There's so many different ways to make that a little bit more compelling. Not put it behind a single fail state. I think we illuminated better transitions as number one thing that GMs have to do to make this run more smoothly. The big twist, either eliminate it or structure it differently.
Yep.
I actually liked the leaving the twist, but having the rival party, because as you did that, I saw the glee in your face when you said, oh, what do you mean, Mordenkainen? And you're like, ha, I'm Kaz, and I already have the other three. Or what have you. So I think I would leave the twist, but I would certainly say he was working it from both angles.
Yep.
That's really the way to
He was Palpatine the entire thing. He was raising the army and raising the other army to defeat the army that he was raising. Like, that's, and then really he was just going to go ahead and pick the hot horse. That's whoever wins, he's still the emperor. Ha. Like, that's, it doesn't matter who wins. Like, that, that's one thing I think that this mission could use is a little bit of gravitas. And I think that's what it's missing. And I think that's really where I see the individual missions themselves need a little bit more depth, and why I think that this would work maybe as two books or something like that, or a bigger book or whatever. But the missions need a little bit more depth, and the plot needs a little bit more gravitas. It's not that they're easy, but they are definitely advanced storyteller tactics, but they are definitely things that storytellers can do to go ahead and help this. If you really know your Eberron, if you really know your Kryn, if you really know your Spelljammer, then you can go ahead and take that bone off of the skeleton and make it a little bit better. Since we're talking about the Spelljammer mission, that Spelljammer map way too small considering that it's a Spelljammer that's crashed on a dead god. There is no reason why two halves of a Spelljamming crew who are only 100 feet apart from one another would not even know that the other side was there. That doesn't make sense.
Yep.
That map needs to be 5 miles long.
I would go one step further, especially since in the adventure. I was almost willing to let that one slide, except for later in the adventure, they make the point of somebody got knocked off the ship and was floating around the astral sea on their own, which you can survive and you can do, other than at some point you got to eat.
You can travel at the speed of thought. You're in the astral sea. You can go wherever you want.
I'm marooned on a ship. I've got my whole party. I'm going to jury-rig something, a dinghy, if that's what it takes. I'm going to push off with my mind, and we're going to row our boat all the way to somebody else's home. I'm not staying on LV-46 or whatever it is, or 42. I'm getting off, and I'm nuking that from orbit.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
So it's like, I didn't play a ton of Spelljammer. I played very little, but I played enough to know that that dog won't hunt.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm so sad because we've talked about it so many times, how bad we wanted to love Spelljammer, how awesome it could have been. And
it could have been so great.
The lament, it continues.
Yep. So we've talked about it a little bit here. It needs better secrets. Yep. The missions themselves need more depth. I will say that other than those two problems, how'd you like to play, Mrs. Lincoln? I will say that absent those issues, where the seven missions that you get to go on, being a newer school gamer than you, I think, had a bigger problem with each mission basically being, I'm dropped at the door of the dungeon. And it wasn't until we were talking about the precursor mission that I was like, oh, wait a minute. That's a throwback to very old school tactics, where everything's a dungeon and you begin each mission at the door to the dungeon. That's a very old school tactic. So I'm softening already on my opinion about that a little bit. I'm a little bit better on it than I was when I first, before we started recording this. So I want to appreciate, I want to observe that. That being said, I still think that each of these missions needed some way for the players to do more than just the one thing that they were there for. I think they needed to go ahead and experience the world a little bit more.
I agree. And so as much as I'm the one who called out the fact that being dropped on the adventure doorstep was a great callback and a lot of fun and really helps in certain circumstances, I think that works in several of the adventures, and I think in other adventures, it leaves a lot to be desired. So here's my thought on that. As much as I think that works, I think it doesn't work 10 chapters in a row.
Yeah, exactly.
I think it worked in the first chapter. I think it worked at Death House.
Mm-hmm.
I think it worked, and by the way, they didn't do that in the Eberron chapter, which was one of my favorite chapters, so that's important to note, right?
Yep.
And I think they didn't do it in Kryn, but oddly, I think Kryn was probably the one that they probably should have. If they weren't going to involve the other elements of Kryn that I think they needed to, they should have dropped it. A big discussion we had when building a Kryn adventure for Splinterverse was, how do we, in X thousand words, make it feel Dragonlance?
Yeah.
If we're not doing the Heroes of the Lance and we are not specifically doing the Knights of Salamnia.
Yeah.
Taking those two options out, we have to hit specific locations that are evocative.
Yep.
And it has to, by definition, include the mages.
Yep.
Of high sorcery. We eliminated three of five things, and it required us to use location and mages.
Yep.
So we centered the story on getting to the mages, and we focused on character development while traveling through the key locations.
Yep.
And that's how we did it. Yep. So if I'm looking at the Eberron chapter, I'm saying, what are the things we're eliminating? We're putting it in the Mornland, so we can't touch any of the other things.
Yep.
I would say, to give it that feel, you put the party in, and I'm going to borrow from an adventure I'm working on, by the way. You put the party in a town outside of the Mornlands on a lightning rail that passes near the Mornlands.
Yep.
And then when the party's passing, their rod part says, you got to get off here. So now they have to find a way to jump the train while in the Mornlands or right next to the Mornlands.
Yep.
And now they are on a little bit of an exploration piece through the Mornlands to do all the same things. The whole adventure is the same, but give it that little bit in between. So yep. The secrets they pick up are from the town that they, the city that they're in, yep. And they get that steampunkiness there. Totally.
Yeah.
And they get the lightning rail, which is very yep. evocative of Eberron. And yep. then they go there. And maybe the rival party's also on the train.
Yep.
So you get a little witch-ish-ish on the train.
You get a little bit of noir feel where you actually, you can go ahead and play up like the kind of the Orient Express kind of train yep. feel about it.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely.
Who's going to be Mr. Piro and all of that. So exactly. I think you do that in the Eberron chapter. I think you drop him on the doorstep of Death House and you do pretty... I say the Eberron was one of my favorite chapters, but I actually thought with a couple minor flaws with it, which are more about how I'm not a big fan of Ravenloft in that way, I actually thought that was a pretty tight chapter,
yep.
the Death House chapter,
yep.
because it puts you there. Ravenloft, by definition, does some things that allow you to play fast and loose with the narrative because you're where you need to be because that's what the powers want.
That's what it calls for, exactly. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Right? So you're in a great spot where that is concerned.
Yep.
So I think if you went chapter by chapter and you figured out where you need to go, or is this a drop on the doorstep? Is this a little exploration piece? What I have done, the Tomb of Horrors bit, I'm sorry, the Tomb of whatever they called it this time around bit, probably no. I would have done something about Icefire Pete or the Great North. I yep. would have done something with Iuz the Old. And yep. if I'm doing Greyhawk, because we already bastardized Tomb of Horrors and called it Tomb of Annihilation, put it in Faerun, I would not go back to that particular well. I yep. would have gone. And we actually stole the Red Wizards of Thay.
I totally disagree with you. For Tomb of Wayward Souls, I would just not run that mission and run the Tomb of Annihilation part of the Tomb of Annihilation campaign path instead. Just lift the Tomb of Annihilation straight out of Tomb of Annihilation campaign
yeah.
and drop it in there. Call it Tomb of Horrors. Make it don't make them fight Mini-Me Re-Rack. Make them fight Acerak. Absolutely. Yeah. Done. Acerak, who worked for Vecna, make him fight Acerak, right? Because that's, you know, this entire book is the greatest hits album for the 2014 D&D releases, right?
It's supposed to be.
It's supposed to be, right?
And came out like Kidz Bops.
It's not that bad. And it's also, they're doing it in a super video gamey way, right? Where it's like, weird confluence of events, you're the only people that can help us, come and do the thing, and you're going to go ahead and meet all these important NPCs along the way that you can't actually interact with, but you can go ahead and talk to, but you can't actually fight them. Sure, you have the opportunity to meet Tiamat, but don't really. You don't actually have the chance to go. You can't do anything about it, but you can potentially be present in her gaze for a moment. I think that the thing that they miss are the mid-level bosses that you encounter along the way, right?
Yep.
Yeah, you get to go ahead and fight Strahd, but you get to fight Strahd at, like, 14th level, when Strahd is going to be a pushover at 14th level, right?
Yeah.
You know, that kind of thing, right? You don't really get to meet Lord Soth, but you get to meet Lord Soth, and that's not really the same thing. You know, all those sorts of things, right?
I did like that one, because I actually think I could have made that scene pretty frightening. Because I love me some Soth. Fair.
It's not on the page.
I will stop.
What we would do with this is not on the page. We cannot count on that. Where I was going to go with all of that, though, the seven rod missions that are in the middle there, they need a lot. They need a lot of heavy lifting from the storyteller. What I think the shining goal or the shining beacon in this mission is the way that it comes together. Whether or not I would gone with the betrayer angle or not, the way that comes together and then the war in Pandemonium. Now, you know me and my love of spiders and how awful that Pandemonium chapter was for me to read through.
I loved it.
I think it's fantastic. I think it's fabulous. I think it's great. Look, I would have given Cass his sword, though. I would have made Cass harder to beat because they're going to be 19th level by that point.
Yeah.
Cass is a CR 23.
Yeah.
Bad guy.
6 on a 23, that ain't shit.
That's 6 level 19 fighter creature.
Yeah.
6 level 19 characters. against one CO. And granted, sure, you can go ahead and give him some lair actions, and but I would have given him his sword. I would have made him a little bit more difficult to go ahead and fight and given him his sword. You know?
Yep. He would have probably taken out a player character. Look, and they're high enough level. As long as he didn't get the cleric, they're probably bringing that fool back. It'd have been fine. Yep. It's just you needed to make somebody say, oh, dang, I don't want to get hit by that. Look, I wrote just this week a whole encounter with special kinds of spiders being ridden as air cavalry, thanks to that crazy meme about venomous spiders, which is not nearly as bad as it sounds, but... Yeah. It did spark my imagination, right? So I wrote a whole thing, and it would have been perfect for this. Yep. I would have made the floors a little higher, so it could have worked a little differently. But, Josh, when you read it, you're going to positively hate my guts. Mm. Cool that came out. But I wrote an encounter specifically because I love using drow, and I love finding neat ways to do things, and... The idea of spiders that can float through the air using webbing parachutes over thermal vents and up currents to stay out of melee range, and allowing the drow to ride on the backs of these things firing down on the party is nasty at higher levels where only range works. Your biggest, baddest fighter has got a lot to fear from a whole cadre of these guys riding Joro spiders. Yep. I love it. Love it. Love it. And right. I think that was a great thing. And if we try to stick on what's on the page versus what we need to do with it, I love the way it came together as well. I thought the Hurricane Tower and its tenuous nature, the ability for the characters to impact the environment of this big battle was amazing. I thought it was a great way to depict how you can have a war going on, but you describe to the players, you don't impact the battle. You handle your piece of the mission, and that will impact the battle. Or you could take out a general, and then you got to skinny out of there and do the other part of your mission, and that will impact the battle. I love the way all those things came together. I love the impact that Hurricane Tower would have on the rest of that section of the campaign. Knocking down a tower and taking out all the folks in it, or many of the folks in it, and taking out a few people in the area below that you have to get to next. Brilliant.
Yep.
I thought that was just a really great way. I really liked that part of the adventure.
Sure.
I like stakes. I like when a small group of heroes are fighting their private war in the midst of a bigger war. It almost has a Saving Private Ryan kind of feel. You've got a squad that's there to do one thing, save Ryan. Meanwhile, it's only D-Day.
Yeah, right. Exactly. Yeah.
I think that was a really nice touch.
Yeah. I thought the same thing about the kind of the very last chapter, right? Where it's like you are going through and seeing what Vecna's plans are in all of these various locations. And your job in all of that is to find the tether between those locations and reality so that you can sever it, right? I thought that that was really craftily done. I thought it was very interesting. And I'm excited to see how that kind of plays out at the table.
I wanted more of that.
Yeah.
Sure. We toured 7 worlds.
Yeah.
But we only got 3 visions.
Yeah.
What I wanted was a alternate version of each of those worlds that was based on something we saw in each of those original things.
Yep.
And the ones they had were great. But I am thinking of the circular nature of narrative and story.
Yep.
If you're going to say, this is the world we know that the guy is trying to destroy, this is the world that he's going to create. Based on that world, show us that mirror universe that he's creating.
Yep. I'm going to take that a step further, right? It is Chekhov's gun. They have been seeding this adventure in all of the adventure paths for years and years with the obelisks that appear through, like, there's one in Icewind Dale, there's one in Tomb of Annihilation, there's one in Descent to Avernus, there's one, I think, in Dragonlance. Like, these obelisks that are tied to Vecna, what if they became the waypoints that allowed him to pivot. They're not obelisks. They're like an axis, right? So that's where they need to go. That's where they get dropped, that kind of thing. But they don't really, these obelisks really don't appear in the missions. So like they've been seeding them for years and years and years and years. They say that they're connected, and the connection's pretty tenuous.
I believe they show up in the Shattered Obelisk, but I don't know that for a fact.
Yeah.
I think that was the trigger that should have been pulled, but I think they pulled it early, so it didn't end up here. It ended up somewhere else, and so we're left with a bit of a nothing burger.
Yeah.
But I agree with you. I think the issue is if you want to do this narrative thing and pull it back, you pull it back. Again, and I hate to keep riding this horse, but let's call it like I see it. The MCU went back to every single point. It was awesome to have Steve Rogers say, yeah, that's America's ass.
Yeah.
That was awesome. He went back to the moment that needed to be, and he was awesome. That's how he did it. Everybody got to go back to a point where something pivotal happened that we saw one version of. And then you got to see this new version of in order for them to then move forward and do the thing. Brilliant. Brilliant.
Yeah.
This was the opportunity they had. Bring us back. You had the obelisk. You didn't want to do that. But at the very least, you went to these seven worlds. Have seven visions.
Yep.
Look, numbers are numbers. Don't go 7-3. It should be 7, yep. 7, and 7. So you can have three groups of seven.
Yep.
Seven or players. Like, you need seven people to do it. So if the player group is four, then you bring in Illustrial and somebody else, and you nerf them however you have to nerf them to keep them at player level, whatever the case may be. But you do 7, 7, and 7.
Here's another idea. Here's another way that you can go ahead and take this, right? So you fight a mission in seven different planes, right? It says at the very beginning that this party has a connection to Vecna, and that you should, as a storyteller, continue to remind them of the fact that they have this connection to Vecna. What if every time either... You could do it either before or do it immediately after, but every time they get a piece of the rod, they get flipped to the other vision, and they need to go ahead and find the tether to go ahead and separate the world that they just saved from Vecna. Take it out of the very last chapter and put it into all of the seven precursor chapters.
Yep. And then when you get through the war piece and you get to the chamber, you see the paths and they're illustrative of what could have been.
Yep.
And Vecna frantically trying to rebuild what you've already severed. And now this is your chance to get into the pool and do the final deed.
Yep, which is why he's only in Archlet's form instead of in demigod form, right?
Because you've been systematically weakening him at every turn. Yep.
And if you don't succeed in severing some of the waypoints, like make them a timed mission. You only have an hour to do it, right? Make it timed. And at the end of that hour, you blip back to Sigil, whether you succeed or you don't. And the number of times you succeed determine how powerful Vecna is at the end. That is the core thing that I keep coming back to, is that every chapter is written in a way that you have to succeed. You can't fail. That's not even that there aren't consequences of failure. It's that the campaign can't continue
if
you fail. It stops. You have to give the players, if you're going to make the players run through this campaign for their 10 highest levels, it's going to be 2 years to go ahead and run through this book, right? You've got to give them the opportunity to fail sometimes. Otherwise, this is like the worst storytelling ever, right? It's, remember when we were in our old LARPing days, we used to talk about how there were storytellers that are like, there were storytellers that wanted to go ahead and tell a story and just wanted everybody else to be witness to it, but wanted you to make sure that you stayed exactly to script every single time, right?
Yep.
It's that kind of story. The rails in this adventure are so tight that it doesn't allow for failure, and that's to its detriment. So,
and I'll even go one step further. Even if they weren't quite that tight, the fact that there's no acceptable fail state to move forward. A TPK is a fail state. You start over the new party. There's no GM advice for if you're building this into your campaign world and your party fails, what happens? Because of the timey-wimey-ness, don't worry about it. other people will rise up. Maybe there's seven other people that can pick up where they left off, find the remnants or what have you. There needs to be advice on how to do that. And then at the end, it's really cool that WotC wants to have this big thing to end 2014, but at the end, either you win or you don't. And they just say you win or you don't.
Yeah.
What the what? But what if my Game Mortal wants to continue? Like, I recognize it's not terribly frequent, but I've been running the same campaign world since 1987.
Yeah.
I guess screw you, Leo and Ika. You don't get to play anymore because you had one party that failed. And I recognize I am one of a very small few group of people. However, the people I game with are, that's what we do. We run, we all decide this is the world we're in. Things lean back on and go back to, and we do whatever. I want a way to say, if you fail, this is what happens afterwards. And I recognize that they're not going to do that because their goal is what happens after this is what we get in 3 months.
Yeah.
So the fact that we can't see that means to be continued? Eh? Weird. At the end of this whole campaign, everything is exactly the same, but in 3 months it's going to be different. Weird.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how to fix that. That is, there's some actual real world issues that cannot change that element of this. And I'd be fine if that was the only, if that was the only thing that was here. But like I said, there needs to be more GM kind of advice, information, assistance,
needs more meat,
conceptualization, just some basic, here's what you do if, to keep this going or to get this fired back up. And I think lacking those things, it's a little tough. This is the kind of campaign that is easy enough to run for a new GM, newer GM, but could easily get horrible because there's a lack of advice. It is also a little too soft for an experienced GM unless they're willing to put in the extra work to homebrew all the extras and all the fixings that need to go with it. And I think that's odd. It's not what I would have hoped. I almost would have hoped they either wrote it for the new ones or they wrote it for us old heads. One or the other would have been fine, and then I could have explained it. This just ain't for you, dudes. Some of us grognards, not everything is made for us grognards, right? Yep. Fandelver, to a lot of us grognards, is like, unless we are trying to run new people in it, boring. I don't think that. I actually have read through it and said, I think this could be really fun. I like it as a start, but I could see, I could understand why people would say that, and I think this tries to ride that middle, and you can't serve all masters. You just can't serve all masters.
I think that is ultimately the point for us to end on tonight, is that, like we said at the very beginning, the shape of this adventure is fascinating. The tack it tries to take is very interesting. The execution is not great. It really had so much opportunity. And it can be fixed. We've talked about this kind of throughout the episode. I think you augment the secret system a little bit, make that a little bit meatier, make the individual locations a little bit meatier, give the players some more options on some things that they can do when they're in Kryn, when they're in Eberron, when they're in Spelljammer, when they're in some all these places.
Overall.
Give them a little bit more to do, thing two, give them a little bit of agency, exactly. And then three, introduce a rival party or some sort of way to go ahead and let them fail sometimes. Because if they're just going to go through and they're going to succeed on everything that they do, then this is just going to be a cakewalk. It's not going to be difficult and it's not going to be fascinating. Yeah. Give them the opportunity to meet some real adversity and fail sometimes and figure out how to go ahead and make that happen. You can do that. This adventure is going to be a lot of fun, I think.
Yeah, I think the way I would look at it is this. Either your party gets it, or the rival party gets it. Vecna might lose either way, but the question is, do you beat Vecna, or does Cass beat Vecna? And if Cass beats Vecna, he can't remake the whole universe. He doesn't have that kind of power. But it does mess up the universe, and now you've got things that future campaigns might need to deal with. right? So you can mess things up without reworking the entire multiverse. Now you got to fix problem X, Y, and Z. Vecna got beat, but he didn't get beat the right way.
Yep.
I think that's the better potential fail state. So I will leave it at that for me, but I will, other than to say, this is a product in the hands of DMs and GMs and storytellers who want to tell great stories. They can start with this, and they can build something amazing. The key is you have to know that going in. You have to prep your table, know your table, and then you got to do some of the lifting. We have a host of episodes on GM tips, how to build different things, how to give good rewards, how to build good backgrounds, how to bring parties together, how to do great NPCs, how to work with sidekicks. There's a whole number of things and a whole host of episodes that we've done specifically that if you put all those pieces together and put those lessons learned into how you run this, you're going to have an amazing campaign. And your players, if they didn't listen to this episode, spent the amount of time running through their 1 through 20, after you've added in all those types of things and they come back and then listen to this, they're going to be like, the hell are these fools talking about? This thing was freaking great. That's what you really want. You want them to look at all of us talking heads on YouTube and on podcasts who have had nitpicky things to say and say, y'all are out of your minds. We had a blast. But GMs will know, yep, you had a blast because I took the time to make it that way. They gave you the stuff that you're going to have.
Yep.
They gave you some ingredients. You got a bento box. Start cooking.
All right, let's see. What is up on the show next week here? Yes, so next week we are going to be bringing back friend of the show, Jay Moores, to go ahead and talk about his game, Faye. Again, he's on the show a couple years ago. And he's also going to be, in the next couple of weeks here, leading us through an actual play of Faye, once again on the show. We're going to be kind of flipping around a little bit where last time we played the Faye monsters. This time we are ostensibly playing not the monsters, although it may not go exactly as we expected. So, yeah, that's going to be starting on the show next week with Jay Moores. And on the preservations front, Lou and Nico recorded a series of quick treks with some of the characters there. We'll get a couple of those coming up here before episode 5 begins. A little bit of precursor to what's going to happen in episode 5. Episode 5 is going to be a two-part episode, so that's going to span for quite a while now. By two-part episode, I mean like a two-session episode. So episodes 5 and 6 are one long story arc, which is going to be really interesting.
We've done a couple two-parters in the lifespan of preservations, and we really enjoy them. We only do it when this tale that we're all spinning together needs to be bigger, broader, badder, all of those things. So really looking forward to it. And the quick tracks are a really good insight into individual characters or groups of characters, and really will inform how they approach the world we've built together in the coming episodes. So it's going to be a lot of fun.
All right, everybody, that is our episode for this evening. So yeah, we will talk to you all next week when we have Jay Moores on the show talking about his game Faye once again. Till then, everybody, thanks for listening. We want to hear your thoughts on Vecna. Also, what are your thoughts on Eve of Ruin? You know how to go ahead and leave us the comments. We'd love to go ahead and hear it. Until then, have a good night, everybody. Thank you very much for listening. We'll talk to you then.
Good night, all.
Thank you for joining us. This has been Tabletop Journeys. We would love to hear your feedback on our show today. Join us at www.ttjourneys.com, where you can subscribe to the blog to leave comments and see all the content that we publish beyond the podcast.
You can also stay in touch by subscribing to our Twitter, Tumblr, or Instagram at TT Journeys, joining our Facebook group, Tabletop Journeys, or by sending an email directly to podcast@ttjourneys.com. Our full episodes come out every week on Friday, and every Tuesday features actual play and gameplay showcase episodes. Looking for early access? You can support the show and get episodes before everyone else at www.patreon.com/TTJourneys. Check it out today and see all the awesome benefits we bring to our supporters.
Lastly, if you're listening to us on Stitcher, iTunes, Podchaser, Spotify, or Audible, we would really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe to the podcast on that platform. Thank you for listening and for being a part of our growing community. And we bid you fair tides, friends, for legends await.